welcome back.
Thank you.
Ms. Sisinski, we thought of you each and every week. And we missed you, and we welcome you and your husband. And we hope you have a continued refuah shalema.
Thank you.
Okay. In your honor, we'll begin a new parak. You see how much we synchronize this?
Boom!
We flew through Parakei, and the truth is that you see the difference because there's only, what is it, 7-8 psukim in Parak Vav, 8 psukim in Parak Vav, but those 8 psukim will take us at least 2 and perhaps 3 shurim, which they're very interesting, and they really are. This is the transition Parak. We think of Noach and the flood and that whole episode in Parshas Noach, and of course that's where it's concentrated, but the transition from, these generations to the generation of Noach and the problems therein. Here, bring the chair here. Are there enough sheets? Is there any extras? If people could share, please. The transition is Perek Vav. So we will. It's a very, very important Perek, and hence the title of tonight's shiur, The Beginning of the End. Yes? Yes, I mean, that's one, some who say. Right.
The fact that he was tumming maybe implies the fact that he was a malice and the fact that he wasn't tzaddik. That was the aura of the scene.
Right.
So
we'll see when we get there. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. We'll get to Noach when we get to Noach. But let's begin Perek Vav now. And what I would like to do is read 2 or 3 psukim, but to focus, really, today's shiur is going to focus on the first 2 psukim. Okay? So we read last week Perakei, which was the transition, the 10 generations that went from Adam to Noach, and we're now in Noach's, so to speak, generation. However, as we'll see momentarily, the Ramban points out, we do go back in time. This is an old issue. I'm not talking just in general about chronology of Psukim, but the point is that even though we have already learned about the 10th generation of Noach, we're going to be learning about phenomenon and behavior, which the Mefarshim say clearly has started occurring before Noach, or certainly before the flood eventually comes, even though in the Psukim they run right into the other. So Perek Vav begins with the following, Vayehi. And it was, just as a parenthetical remark, I didn't put it on the sheet, but the Gemara in Megillah has a fascinating back and forth whether the word Vayehi and it was, or is it indicating something ominous? The Gemara begins by saying that, yes, anytime you have a Vayehi, that's why it's in the Megillah, because of the beginning of the Megillah's Esther. That's why it's in that tractate of Megillah. But come on in. No, not at all. Ellie, can you make sure there's some chairs for them? So the Gemara says perhaps Vayhi indicates something ominous, and it gives other proofs, including our pasuk, that Perek Vav begins the transition, the descent into the depths of depravity, which lead to the flood. So perhaps that's another indicator that it's something ominous. But then the Gemara says, well, perhaps there are other indications where Vayehi represents something karv, or perhaps even something positive. And well, then the Gemara concludes, well, Vayehi BMA, that's for sure something bad. Right? So there are other examples. The Gemara gives a number of examples, but that's just, as I say, as an aside in that discussion. But the bottom line is, one way or the other, there is something bad about to happen, and our parak begins with the words Vayehi. And it was, ki hechel ha'adam larov al pnei ha'adama, as the when man, the species obviously, began to increase, began to propagate on the face of the earth, ubanos yuldu lahem, and daughters were born to them. Question number one, of course, is, come on, by now you're all trained. Why all of a sudden, what's the issue? All of a sudden now just daughters, it's just the populations, all boys, now all daughters. What exactly happened? Why, and it's presumably evident and obvious that that's not the case. So what exactly is being stressed by saying, ubanos, that girls or daughters were born to them? So we have the introduction, there's some transition now, a new population boom, and then daughters are being born to them. But Yiru Bnei HaElohim, or Elohim, that's a question, how to translate that, how to pronounce that word. what exactly is being connoted here. Is it something that is sacred, and therefore Elohim should be the right pronunciation, or is it Elohim? Sometimes we know that Elohim can be used to refer to something earthly. What's the classic example?
Judges.
Right. Judges are referred to, right, as Elohim. We pronounce the hey. Sometimes idolatry, on the contrary, idolatry is sometimes referred to in a context of a phrase with Elohim, and certainly we want to focus on that. So the question here is, we'll see in the commentaries, obviously, again, whenever you have that word in a non-obviously God-focused pasuk like ours, could this be Hashem? What does it mean? Especially if you refer to it as, usually, let me take a step back for a moment. If you see the word Elohim, so instinctively, what would you assume? Right, that it's God. So what might indicate here that it's not? B'nai. The son of. The son of God, right? That's not our religion. B'nai, right? So on the one hand, we don't know exactly what it means. Who's it referring to, if it's referring to something manly? And if it's referred to something divine, so then what do you make of such a conjugation? So, anyway, at some point, these B'nai Elohim, Elohim, they saw es benos ha'adam. They saw the daughters of man. Now again, an ambiguous phrase. I mean, the words are easy enough to translate, but what does it mean? The daughters of which man? Who man? Who? Are these the same daughters from the first pasuk? Who, you know, what about these daughters? Ki tovos heina, that they were very good. Now, of course, this is the old question, right? When you say she's a really nice girl, what do you mean? And of course, all the guys will tell you that you could mean one of two things. You could mean she's a really nice girl, and what else could you mean? Really, she's nice. Not pretty. Right? There's pretty much two ways that that phrase could be used. Boys learn that, and there's a secret handshake in adolescence that you learn, and this is part of the secret handshake. So what does that mean, ki tovo zeina? What about these girls, the B'nai Elohim, B'nai Elohim, what did they like? What does that mean, tovo zeina? But yilchu lahem, but whatever it was something, nashim mikol asher b'charu, and they took for them, they chose them to be their wives. But to make that sentence, to make that phrase flow, you probably could have ended after the word nashim. Right? Kitova, these men saw these women, yilchu lahem nashim, and they got married. So what's the modifier? Mikol asher b'charu, from whoever they chose. Well, I mean, yilchu lahem nashim means they chose. So what it's a little bit of a choppy pasuk. Am I being clear? Anyone see, you understand what I'm saying? It's a choppy pasuk a little bit, in that sense. The end is at least a little bit choppy. Let's just read one more pasuk, because this is really a transition. And originally I had intended to include commentaries on pasuk Gimel tonight as well, but as I was preparing the sheet, I realized that there was enough just on the first two pasukim that we really would probably not get to pasuk Gimel. But the truth is, pasuk Gimel really goes with the first two pasukim. It's a transition. And pasuk Gimel itself is a hard pasuk. There's tons of commentary just on pasuk Gimel, which we'll have to see in future weeks. But Yomer Hashem, so seeing this, whatever it is, and again, that's why this is such an important shir tonight, something happened in these two pasukim, which transitioned from an otherwise tranquil 10 generations to leading to the cataclysm of the flood. How do we know that? Because of pasuk Gimel. Because Hashem looks at what was just described in these two pesukim, which seem perhaps confusing, but it seems innocuous enough. There were these types of men, we don't exactly know who they were. We saw these types of girls, we don't know who they were, and they got married. I mean, that's all we've seen so far, right? But somehow, as a result of that, the Torah says, pasuk Gimel, Vayomer Hashem, and Hashem said, Lo yadun ruchi ba'adam, my spirit will not yadun, we'll have to see this next time. How do you translate yadun? What is our article translated as? Contend. Will not accept, will not be willing to contend with this people, the Olam, anymore or forever. B'shagam hu basar, because after all, he is flesh. B'hayu yamav me'av esrim shan, and therefore his days will only be 120 years. What exactly that pasuk means is very unclear. That'll be next week. But one thing is clear even in the pshat, right? Hashem is not happy. Right? There's clearly an ominous overtone to this pasuk. And then in pasuk Dalet, we begin with these mysterious creatures known as the Nephilim. They're giants, fallen angels, or something that were on the earth in those days. and you know, things from there. You're skipping the pasuk Hey, Hashem says Ki Rabba Ra'as Ha'adam Baretz. Right, everything is going bad, and the famous pasuk V'chol Yetzer Machshav Libo Rak Ra Kol Hayom. Right, everyone's doing wickedness and evil, and Hashem is sad. And then the parak and the parsha continue and concludes with Hashem's affirmation, His decision: I'm going to destroy everything. That's the flood, and then we're ready to set the stage for the focus of that. So the transition in this short, the truth is that the parak is a longer parak. It's just that for whatever reason, and we do have this every now and then, the parsha ends mid-parak. We do have that every now and then. It's interesting to see if we can figure out why that is, but the parsha ends after eight psukim. So if we look at that as a self-contained unit, this is a transition from, again, these 10 generations leading to the cataclysm of the flood. And even within the eight, you see a transition. The eight is a unit or a transition, but within the eight, there are different sections. And that first section, which seems to be the kickoff, we will begin tonight. Okay? So let's take a look for a moment at the first two sources on your sheet, even before we take a look at Rashi. Okay? Rashi tells us the following. The first source tells us in a Gemara in Baba Basra, tells us that there is a word here which could be read in one of two ways. And that is when the Pasuk says, Ki achil ha'adam, so how do we pronounce that word? What do we say? Larov. So it's a weird form of the word. So the Gemara in Baba Basra actually has two theories as to what that means. Especially as the continuation of the pasuk is, Ubenos Yuldulem, and they had daughters. And we asked what was being signified by that. Presumably they didn't only have daughters. So the Gemara quotes a debate. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Revia Bali Olam, that there was some great population boom. That's what's being alluded to. That's not the one I want to focus on. However, which is really that's the gist of the pasuk. And that's how I think the article probably translates it. Right. Okay. What's fascinating to me is Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish Amar Meriva Ba Li'olam. What's being indicated here is that Machlokas came to the world. Now, sorry? So apparently you meant not individually, not isolated. You're right. In isolation, you can't have more than one person killing another, obviously. But apparently the whole culture became subsumed in machlokas. Now, I stress this for one main reason, which is because, as most of us are familiar, and we're going to see it alluded to in some of the Mepharshim continuing this week, and then when we get to Noach, and in Pasuk Yud Gimel, in Parshas Noach, the famous phrase, what's the famous descriptive used for what was so bad about the generation of Noah? What's the word that's used? Chamas. So chamas is usually refers to like theft, basically. That's generally what it implies. We'll see already in some of the Mepharshim momentarily that it may imply other things. But a third thing, which willy-nilly must be included, at least according to Reish Lakish, characteristic of the generation of the flood is machlokas. Now, what seems to me significant is because it's like it's almost as if Reish Lakish is going out of his way to find machlokas here. And it's interesting because we have, as you all know, so many makoros about other destructions in our history which are brought back to machlokas. And here you have the first churban of the whole world, and it's almost as if Reish Lakish is telling you, don't think that little things like just Beis HaMikdash and dispersion come from machlokas. Right? It's not just the little things like the Jewish people being ripped apart. The whole world was destroyed from machlokas. And you'll tell me, weren't there other things? So again, we'll have to see when we get to those psukim and parshas Noach, but at least for now, my working theory would be, according to Reish Lakish, when you have a generation that's characterized by machlokas, and that doesn't just mean literally they got into a fight, it means disunity, distrust, maliciousness, etc. So then that leads to the other stuff. Right? When you're very warm and cordial, a sense of achdus and neighborly relationship with the person next door, you're less likely to sneak in the middle of the night and steal their stereo. I think that's a safe bet. So it may not necessarily be a conflict with the general understanding of Hamas, but what it may be saying is there's something even underlying it. And it's interesting to me, if that's the case, I haven't seen this anywhere, but I think if you, Rish Lakish forces us to think out of the box, but it's interesting because when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, fast forward a few, some millennia, we have different sources and tradition, which you're all familiar with. But the truth is that, and I pointed this out, I think, at times on Tisha B'Av, certain commentaries point out that if you add together all the Gemaras that offer theories of destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, they don't all overlap. In other words, they seem to be contradictions. Was it Sinas Chinam? Was it this? Was it that? There's different. The Gemara in the Nedarim says, well, they didn't say Berchas HaTorah, and this one, and the different things going on. And some of the commentaries there try to suggest it's not a conflict, but rather the Gemara in one place is suggesting that there's an underlying cause of the other. In other words, maybe that on the final straw was Aveira X, but you want to know how they got to such a bad state? There's what we call, right, and now in modern sociology, right, root cause. So perhaps that's what Reish Lakish is saying. Yes, there's a chumas that's going to come. But what was the root cause? The root cause was Meriva. The root cause was Machlokes. Now it's interesting, I was wondering, perhaps it's in some of your minds as well, so what does it have to do with Benos Yoldu Lahem? Right, the daughters. So I saw...
All those fights came over women.
So either they were fighting over the girl who we don't know if she was Tovos or not, right? Maybe that's a proof that it means she was really pretty. That's why they were fighting. Or I did see that the Marsha says on the Gemara that this is going back to the issue which Chazal talked about, how if one has a blessed marriage, so then everything works in harmony. But if a marriage, if you're not Zoche, so then it's not, then it's connected, you know, Ishto connect, you know, Ezer connecto in the sense of conflict. In other words, What I think, again, I'm not saying this is Pashup Shat in the Chumash, but what the Marsha is probably trying to get at, which I do believe is a true psychological phenomenon and emotional reality, is that the relationships that we're closest with and have the most ability for actual warmth and emotional support, so it's just the flip side of that coin. Those are the relationships that are also the most combustible. Which I think gets back to my own relationships theory, is vulnerability. In other words, you can't love, you can't have intimacy without vulnerability. But by definition, when you make yourself vulnerable, so if for whatever reason it doesn't work, so the pain is obviously that much more searing than if you had never made yourself more vulnerable. So it could be that, again, I'm definitely going beyond what it says in these texts, but it could be if you put it all together, what is being suggested is that not just that the machlokas is the root cause, but it was really a breakdown of the family that was the root cause. Well, which kind of machlokas? The machlokas between husband and wife. And once you have the breakdown, and that type of machlokas can be far more explosive than, you know, the person who cut you off on the highway, or the, you know, even a coworker. Whereas the more regular the relationship, the more trust there is in a relationship, potentially the more vulnerable it is to explosion and the damage and the hurt that it can cause. And if you have the closest relationship that's possible not working out and those being destroyed, so then between the husband and wife, you know, we have the infamous scene of the battle, was the battle of the war of the roses, right, the throwing of the plates and everything that goes on with that. And again, our generation in America can certainly bear witness to that, we see, and once that breaks down with the parents, so the children and their children and their children, then it's, you could see how, right, you get to the chumas, you know, impulse of good gimel. So I don't know that any of this is necessarily true, and according to Rabbi Yochanan, there's no source for saying any of what we just said. But according to Reish Lakish, it could be that that would be a possible way of putting this all together. A Ramban also, before we get to really analyzing Pshat and Pasuk Beis, a Ramban as well. The Ramban says, if you take a look at the second source, the Ramban also points out something very interesting. And that is the following. Kasher hizkira kosov Noach uvanov. At the end of last parak, we got to the 10th generation of the human race, which was Noach and then his children. Now that we've gotten there, we, so to speak, go back. Talk about what happened even before then. Now we're ready to tell you not only about the flood, but about what led to the flood. Amar, it's kind of the, you know, the authorial Amar, so to speak, the narrator, Ayi Hashem, the Torah decided to tell us, Kimiyad kasher hecholu b'nei ha'adam l'rov, once species got bigger, it wasn't just a family, but now you're getting into a whole society, hecholu lachto, right? You multiply the people, you multiply the weakness, you multiply the iniquity. But Amdu, and here's where the Ramban says something very interesting. all of these problems didn't just start in the time of Noah. Omdu bechetam yamim rabim. These things that are being described, we'll see momentarily in Pasuk Beis, the Mefarshim describing, and then of course when we get to the next Parsha in Noach, and those Pesukim of Chamas, these were not new phenomena. They were going on for a while. Ad shahaya Noach ben Dalet Meos Hashmonim Shana. These were going on not only in the beginning of Noach's life, but they went on for 480 years. And only then, Ba'oz Gazra Leim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, only after so many years of this, that Hashem decides Shlo Yadon Rucho Vahem La'olam. Again, whatever exactly that means, that was supposed to Gimel, we'll see. But Hashem said, I've had enough. We're going to have to do something about it. But it didn't happen right away. Yarech Od Lahem Shanim. Hashem still was patient and gave them second and third chances. He gave them years to, so to speak, you know, make it up. Right? Until he just said, that's it. I have no more patience. I can't wait any longer. Ki kein mishpat ha'elokim. And so, in a kind of a profound conclusion, says Ramban, this is the way of Hashem's judgment. In other words, Hashem is an erech apayim. Hashem is patient. Hashem gave them hundreds of years to get their act together. He gave them many second chances. Even though the Torah is telling this us, you know, it's in the timeline of the psukim, this is all going to be happening sequentially. In fact, it happened not in such a short period of time, but over a long period of time. Hashem, and again, to me, in a certain sense, it's almost obvious, but I guess I'm glad the Ramban pointed out, because if you take a think about it for a moment, Hashem did destroy the world. You'd like to think that it wasn't a snap decision. You know, just had a bad day and said, that's it! You know, which we as parents, you know, sometimes do, right? Sometimes the smallest thing, even if it's real, but in any other context, we might have dealt with it one way, but because of, we're in a bad mood, we had a bad day at work, so, you know, roar. You know, so, like, you know, so when you do something little like that, you know, it's okay, but if you did something major, you'd like to think that the major decisions were not rash ones, right? No more major decision destroying the world. And again, imagine for a moment, again, this one we'll have to stress more when we get to the decision itself and to Parshas Noach as well. But again, this is, you know, as my father told me more than once, and I have still years later, 20 plus years later, vivid memories of this one particular incident, but I have to say it was not just once, when he would look at me and say, trust me, this hurts me, when he was punishing me, more than it hurts you. I'm not doing this because I'm not doing this because I want to. Right? So that, you know, once you become a parent, you realize what that meant. Right? It's so painful for us to have to punish, especially if it's really punish, children, right? So imagine Hashem, not just a parent of all the people, but the whole world. This was, forgive the pun, this was his baby, right? The world. And he's going to destroy it. I mean, just imagine that. Right? So, again, the Ramban is pointing out something which is, in a certain sense, obvious, but I think it's necessary to point out. This was not some snap decision, and we would understand why. You know, it would and did and should have taken something major to get Hashem to try to make such a radical decision. After all, right, he didn't say we destroy the whole world when Cain killed Abel. That was bad. But he dealt with Cain. But obviously here something is broke. And as we all know, in certain, you know, in organizations or systems, sometimes you can fix the problem, and sometimes when it's so broke, you just got to start over. You need to melt down. And obviously that's the process, which is, on the one hand, since we know there's a more radical decision that was taken, we can assume that the problem was obviously more radical and systemic. We don't exactly know what the problem is yet. We see a little bit of this machlokas idea, and now, for the rest of tonight's share, we'll begin to start learning what exactly was going on in this generation, and the focus will be this mysterious, enigmatic Pasuk Beis, where you have the Bnei HaElohim Elohim, the Benos HaAdam, they're getting married. What's going on? Yes, Gene.
Yeah, I think the Pasuk Beis is very profound, notwithstanding our lack of understanding for what Bnei HaElohim is. But I think the use of the words, the Lakhu, what is it? The Lakhu? They took, you know, like against the will of just taking.
Well, we'll have to see if that's what it means. We'll have to see. Many of them are going to say what you just said, and we'll see exactly that. Rav Hirsch, as an aside, disagrees and points out that the Torah refers to marriage with the same verb, ki yikach, and therefore he gives a different theory as to what's wrong. But you're not incorrect that many of the Mefarshim we'll see in a moment do say exactly what you just said.
Everybody, this is a very technical question. I mean, it's certain, many of that, because we can understand in human relations that obviously murder or stealing or whatever. But the Ramban, which triggered my attention, was the Ramban uses the word chait. And in our world and in our context, we think of chait as in violation of something. And I'm wondering, before we had the Sheva Mitzvah.
Good, very good.
Came and started the whole
so thing. It's funny that you asked. It's funny that you asked the question about the Ramban, because it's the Ramban himself of all. It's the Ramban who, as we'll see, if you peek down, you'll see there's more Rambans on the page. The Ramban himself is going to address this later.
Okay.
All right. So my first question, which I want to deal with now in section two here on the sheet, is who are these people? Before we can know what was going on with them, what they did wrong, we need to know who are they. And the Torah gave us this very weird phrase. The boys, the men are benos Elohim or Elohim, we don't even yet know how to pronounce the word, and the women are benos ha'adam. What do those things mean? And basically there are, let's start with the men, three different theories in the Mefarshim. It's enigmatic, which is why it leads to a multiplicity of possibilities and theories. Now let's begin and take a look at Rashi. Rashi tells us the day. So the first thing he tells us is you can pronounce it Elohim, no problem. B'nei Hasarim, who are these people? They are the sons of the lords, the Hashoftim, and the judges, right? The Torah didn't give us all the details. We don't need to know every detail of every society. But, you know, in any given society, you imagine there's somebody who's going to become the powerful, the lord, the leader, the judge, the hierarchy, the upper class, the rulership, the ruler class. So it was their children that we're talking about, right? The rich kids, right? That I'm not. You'll see in a moment. That's exactly what Rashi is alluding to. There was this upper class of adults, this ruling class, and the Bnei Elohim are their sons. That's the first theory of Rashi. Stop there and take a look at your sheet. Where is Rashi getting this from? He's getting it from a Medrash. Rashi is quoting a Medrash, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Kara Lahon b'nei Dayana. These are the sons of the judges. And again, here it doesn't just mean judges in some very limited vocational sense, as opposed to the sons of the doctors or the accountants. It means these are the sons of the leaders, of the rulers, of the upper class. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai goes so far as to say that there's going to be another theory, but he says, another theory which looks at this word in a holy, divine context, and therefore we're pronouncing it with maybe Elohim, and Rav Shimon Bar Yochai goes so far as to say, Mekalel kol man dekara lehun b'nei Elohaya. Anyone who thinks that there's something divine or godly associated with this word and this phrase, they should be cursed. Why? Because after all, we don't yet know what they did wrong, but apparently they're the source of the problem. So to ascribe the source of the problem to some divine creature or person, so that's almost like blaming Hashem. So he says, that can't be. Now again, hold that in abeyance, because we'll have to see that there are others who do say that it is. But so far we have the source for Rashi, that who are we talking about? Who are these young men? They're the children of privilege. They are the rich kids, and you know, and the kids who got to drive the nice car to school at 16. They are the children of the leadership ruler class. And then Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai continues and gives us tremendous morals. A tremendous moral. Tani Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, this is not in Rashi. And we know we've seen this now in our 2+ years learning together. So it's always important to check the original Medrash. Because Rashi is often just giving you a snippet of the Medrash, but the actual source is often richer with other messages. Kol pirtza, she'ena min hagadolim, eina pirtza. You know what? We're always prefacing. You know, we say, when wasn't it a bad time for the Jews? You know, and I can't remember who was it, a recent speaker who got up, and maybe it was Rabbi Weinreb, I guess, for the Yerushalayim rally. He says it's a difficult time, but he goes, I can't imagine when was it in the last, you know, 1,000 years that we didn't say it's, you know, it's a difficult time for the Jews. So Shimon ben Yochai says, I'll tell you. You know, you're right. There's always problems. There's always problems. But not all problems are problems. Not all pirtzos are pirtzos. You want to know what's a real pirtza? When you have a problem with the leadership. That the Hamonam, that everyone else, the proletariat, is doing this and doing that. No, we try to fix it, but we can survive midor lador with problems. But when the Gedolim, as he calls them, when the leaders are doing it, that's when you have a problem. Then the system is broken. And he quotes, I don't know what the source of this is, but a very pithy idiom, which is actually talking about Avodah Zarah. A Qumrayim means the Qumar, it's like the priest for Avodah Zarah. He says, if the priest will steal the idols, Gunvu Elohai, if the priest steals the idols, Man Mumebe, is someone going to still give donations to the temple? Or Man Makariv, people are still going to bring sacrifices to that church, that temple, that mosque, that whatever? In other words, when you have the leaders who are corrupt, so you know that the whole thing is going to go downhill. Then you have a real, real problem. And therefore, in essence, what Shem Rechai is telling us, we still haven't identified what these Bnei Elohim did wrong. But in case you were wondering, whatever it was, couldn't we have just punished them? Why punish the whole world? So implicitly, Shem Yochai is already responding to that question and telling us no, because when you have this, you know, the fish, what is it, rots from the head down? Right? When you have the top generation, right, the kids, you know, who were themselves, then became the leaders, but when they were already corrupted, whatever it was, so then the whole generation falls apart. You can't have, no one's going to follow a group of corrupt leaders. So everything is going to dissolve. And unless you can remove them and put in moral leaders, in the end you're just going to have a wild west. It's going to be terrible. Now as an aside, he asks, Medrash again, such an important Medrash, so if this is the case, why, in such a terrible context, why do we use the word Elohim? You know, it's so confusing. You know, and Mela, when it comes to judges, the classical answer is because a judge, like a big Talmud Chacham, you know, is a reflection of Hashem, so we use Elohim, it's a double entendre. But here it's just the opposite. Why use a godly type word if we clearly don't mean that? So the Medrash offers a theory. Tells us at the end of the line, Shehirbu Yamim Pelot Sa'ar. Because they actually looked like they were living like kings. They were living like gods. Like they strode the earth. Nothing ever affected them. Nothing ever bothered them. They lived many, many years, these wicked people, and not even had any problems. Ublo Yisurin. So, what are you... The wheels should be turning. So you'll ask, no. I thought I was a better teacher than that.
Why?
Why? You just told me how bad they were, and because they're the leadership, they're going to ruin, they're going to bring the whole world down with them. So you tell me, well, they got to live a long life with no problem. You know, where do I sign up? You know, I always wanted to be one of those kids. Yeah. What's the, you know, at least those kids in school, if they got, you know, those rich kids who got spoiled by their parents and round up on drugs, at least they got punished. They kicked out of school. But if nothing ever happened to them, that's when you were jealous of them. So why not? So here, again, very profound. I mean, this is where, if you look at the title of our series, the theology comes in. You have tucked into this narrative a tremendous nugget of hashkafa, a tremendous theological statement. Rabbanin Amrin, Keshi'u Shalahem B'Shaldoros Habayim Achareyim. Hashem wanted that all of the schar, you know, they accidentally did something right at some point in their life, all of the schar that they or their children should ever deserve, should get rewarded in this world. So there's nothing left in the account that they would deserve being rewarded for in the next world, so that all of their punishment could be meted out without any mercy in the next world. And this is now tonight's topic. This is not our shir, it's not our topic to discuss tzaddik v'ra'lo and theodicy, but in that discussion of evil in the world and how do we make sense of it, so one of the theories which has numerous sources, a definitely legitimate traditional strain of thought in Jewish thought, is exactly this idea that it's a balancing act, that there's reward or punishment in this world, there's reward or punishment in the next world, and the assumption is that it's much more intense in both directions in the next world. And sometimes the answer is given, why does tzaddikim are having, you know, suffering a little bit here? And sometimes the answer is, well, we'll get their punishment, because no one's perfect, out of the way now, so that in the next world they can just have pure reward. And the flip side, which is what this Medrash is saying, is you have other people who are wicked, so we'll give them all the reward in this world, so that with a clean heart, with a clean conscience, without any confusion, we can just blast them in the next world. As far as I know, this is one of the earlier, you know, if you look at this as a commentary on one of the first psukim in the Torah, so in that sense, it's one of their first statements to this effect. Again, you miss all this in Rashi. Rashi just gave you two words. But Rashi was basing himself, Kitzer, in shorthand, on this Medrash. So if you take a step back from what are we seeing from Rashi in this Medrash? This is the ruling class. These were the big shots. They had, you know, every opportunity, every luxury in the world. They were given every opportunity. They came from privilege. And somehow, we don't yet know why, but somehow they used that in a way that wasn't just immoral or detrimental for themselves, but brought down an entire generation. If you take a look for a moment at Rasag, Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, he tells us something very interesting. he agrees with the Medrash, B'nei HaNasiim, but then he tells us, which the Medrash didn't, Sanu, who are the girls? Now we know this is that cool kid driving the Beamer at 16, you know, pulling up in the high school parking lot. You know, this is the B'nai Elokim. So who are the girls? Nu. Benos Adam. Benos Hamone Ha'am. From the opposite end of the tracks, from the other side of town. Right? B'nai Elohim, that's the privilege, leadership, ruler class. Right? What would be the opposite image of Elohim? Ha'adam, right? Lowly, earthly. They went, apparently, Badafka, after girls who were from poor homes, no opportunities, no chance. Now, again, if we take this, you know, isolation, you might think, wow, how wonderful. True love triumphs. You know, they're not just looking for women of privilege themselves, they're just looking at the person. Right? We'll have to, you can imagine. And that's halavai. Halavai. But, you know, you see at least right now in that sense that potential. The Ramban also quotes this theory that the people we're talking about here, this is a class discussion. Class, you know, in terms of a class system. B'nei Hasarim HaShoftim, says the Ramban, quoting Rashi. Now, just to add, so to speak, insult to injury, piggybacking on this idea of the Medrash, which again, the Ramban himself didn't quote, and even Rashi didn't quote, but this idea that it's particularly injurious, it's particularly problematic when it's this group of people, this class of people that fall into disrepute. So the Ramban in his own way says something very sharp. Take a look. He basically says, what I would describe the Ramban is two words, bitter irony. In Cain, Yisab Erakosov, this is the case, that these who were these young men were, they came from these families. Ki hadayonin, asher lehem lasos mishpat. So what comes out? That the judges, the rulership class, the ones who are supposed to be leading by example and by enforcing morality and ethics and justice in the society, b'nehem, osim achamas bagalui, v'ein monea osam. Who is going to stop them? Their fathers? In other words, this is the ultimate spoiled child of privilege. Right? The parent is living ostensibly a leadership, normal, good life. But they give the child everything and the child is rebelling. So you have, I mean, we've all seen it, two possibilities. You have sometimes where the parent is willing to lay down the law, but more often than not, and the Ramban says, this is what happened. You had problems, right? And problems always start out small before they get big. Why didn't the judges, in whatever civil law they had then, you asked me about the law, Larry, he asked me about the law. So, what, Harry, whatever that law was now, but why didn't the judges, the leaders, the rulers stop it? We can't. It's our sons. Right? People often have a double standard for their own children. Right? They were the type of father and parent and mother who were making excuses. Well, you know, I had a lot of homework. And, you know, it's really hard to balance, you know, like riding lessons and ice skating lessons, you know, and we have to go shopping with a personal shopper. You know, it's so hard to be us. You know, they're making all sorts of double standards for their children, right? They should know better. But when it comes to and if it'll be someone else's son, first offense, throw him in jail. My son, I'm going to use my connections, get him off. It doesn't have to be, but it certainly can be. And says the Ramban, that is what was in that generation. So in essence, as we'll see, when you have a victim, so who are they going to look to for justice when the judge is the father of the perpetrator? So not only do they not get redress in the short term, but what type of cynicism does that create? What does that breed? And the answer is chamos, and eventually destruction as a result. The Ibn Ezra also offers this as one of the opinions. The Ibn Ezra is a good transition for us because he tells us that there's two other theories. Till now we've seen all one theory from Rashi and the Medrash. Who are the Bnei Elohim? The children of privilege. Ibn Ezra says that's true, but there's two other theories. Let's skip the middle one for a second and we'll get back to that. Let's go to the third one. V'yesh Omrim ki Bnei HaElohim Bnei Sheis. Elohim should be pronounced that way because we don't mean divine. We're talking about a human being. But we're talking about the spiritual upper class, not the privileged class or the rulership class, but the spiritual, the religious aristocracy, namely the line of Sheis, right? We know that from Adam, there were basically two lines, in essence, right? Because obviously, Hevel didn't have a chance. Cain himself was bad, and we assumed that the tree rotted that whole line. We saw this in Parakeh when that generation is listed, right? With that line is listed, we go through Shase. Right? Shase, that doesn't mean there were no children of Cain. We know that. They weren't listed in Parakeh because that's not the pure line, quote unquote, that gets us to the big tzaddikim, like Hanok and Mesushelach, etc. Right? The big tzaddikim were from Shase and his family. So what's the irony here? It's Davka says that Ben Ezra, according to this theory, the Bnei Shase, the children and the great-grandchildren, etc., from the spiritual aristocracy, the ones who really knew better, they were the ones, unfortunately, who did something wrong. So who's Benos HaAdam? Benos Mishpachas Kayin. So we don't yet know, according to any theory, according to, it's still this one, what did they do wrong? But we haven't seen that yet. What did they do wrong? But according to the first theory, especially if you include Rothena Sajagon, you have the ruling, almost affluent upper class, with the girls from the other side of the tracks. And in a somewhat similar vein, but with a different focus, you have this other theory now, which, as we'll see, Rav Hirsch takes and runs with this theory, in a way that is very surprising, but he does, that we have a different, so to speak, dichotomy or paradox. We have the children of the spiritual elite, Bnei Shais, with the daughters of, the corrupt ones. And in that sense, you would almost say, second generation Karayim. It's not necessarily their fault. They were brought up in generations of Kayim, but the bottom line was, Ad Shinnach. Right? So what does it mean when the Torah says here that these spiritual boys saw these girls from Kayim, Ki Tovos? Right, probably does not mean that they were saying Tehillim all day, that they were good girls. Here the good, we can imagine according to this theory, what the good meant. Right? Okay, this is what the Torah is describing for us.
Benos Elohim couldn't get a date.
Well, it's still to this day, the best girls have the hardest time. It's still true. And they didn't have a Starcade off or anything to help out. Okay, now what is the third theory? The third theory is the one that we saw rejected by the Medrash. And as we'll see, that was, with all the respect to the Medrash, other Midrash from other sources accepted. Namely, that we should be, in a certain sense, I use this as an illustration, referring to this as Elohim. Namely, that here we're not talking about regular human beings, being the upper class, lower class, rich, spiritual. We're not talking about regular human beings. Take a look at Rashi in your Chumash. Dover Acher, you see the parentheses? My Rashi's in parentheses. Is yours in parentheses? Dover Acher, again, we're in Paraglav, Pasuk Beis. The opening Rashi, the first thing Rashi said was it was the children of the judges and the rulers. Says the Rashi, a second theory, Dover Acher, B'nei ha'elokim, alim, heim ha'sarim, these are the quote-unquote lords, but it doesn't mean here, as you'll see in a moment, the judges in the human sense, ha'holchim b'shlichusa shalamakom. These are the ones who are the angels, who are representatives, agents, of Hashem. Afheim hoyu misarvim behem. And these angelic figures or personalities were intermingling, commingling with these human beings, specifically with these Benos Adam. Now, just like the previous theory, we needed a little background. Rashi didn't give us the whole story. So this theory also of Rashi is coming from another larger context. Now again, it's worth noting that the Medrash that we saw said, how could it be, Chas HaSholem, how could you attribute these are angels or some form of angels? They're the source of the destruction. But other sources, like this Rashi, acknowledge that that's their source, but basically say, but they got corrupted. So what's the case? I'll show you a few sources that highlight this point. So first of all, take a look at the Eben Ezra. On the first line, the middle, the one we skipped, right? The first theory we saw was the Eben Ezra is the rulers. The third theory we saw from the Eben Ezra was it was Shase versus Kain. But look at the second the end of that first line. The Eben Ezra said, Yeshom, in the middle theory, Ki Elohim b'makom hazeh kadosh. Elohim, you have to pronounce it Elohim. Who is it referring to? These were the, somehow, some form of angels. Again, the Eben Ezra doesn't tell us, but he's clearly aligning with this. The second theory in Eben Ezra is like the second theory in Rashi. And what's the basis of this? There's a few midrashim and even one gemara and a Rashi. Take a look at the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer tells us in the next source, Rabbi Omer, Hamalachim shenaflu mimakom kedushasan min hashamayim. There were some angels who came down to this world. Ro'u es b'nei dorosav shel kayin. and they see these girls from the family of Cain, and apparently they were enticing, because the girls of Cain didn't dress mitzvias with the skirt and the, you know, and the shaitel. They didn't dress that way in Cain's family. Kaluyos baser erva, right? They were dressed in a very tantalizing and revealing way, the daughters of Cain. And the angel's eyes got very wide. Enayim kizonos, and their eyes, they looked very enticing. V'to achareihem, and they were led astray because they were enticed by these women. Alochu mehen nashim, and they married them in an improper way. And that is how the Pirkei Eliezer reads the rest of the next of the pasuk. Bichlchem nashim yikol asher bachar. These angels were enticed by these less than tzadekes.
Whole context of a malach, we think a malach is
yes,
absolutely a
shliach. Yeah, exactly. Which is why the first medrash says chas v'shalom.
Yeah,
fallen angels.
Right. So fallen here is what we would say in Hebrew, tarti mashma. Right. They were fallen in more than one sense. Right. They didn't just come to this world where they took some human form, which we know from other stories in Tanakh of such a concept, but furthermore, they really fell. Take a look at one more source. There's other sources. There's a whole other medrash which I couldn't find, but I saw quoted, which speaks about angels which are basically looking down at the corruption of Cain and his family, and so to speak, almost taunting Hashem in the same way that the, you know, like in the generation of, in the story of Eov, the angels are saying to Hashem, look at this guy, you think he's so good? So Hashem said, you think it's so easy? He's surrounded by such a, you know, priestess. You think you could be such a tzaddik? You know, you try going down there and, you know, and living a moral life, and drop these two angels down who are taunting, and sure enough, they got it coming to them.
Rashi is a little troubling that the second shot, because it indicates that Hashem sent them; they were going b'shlichus, and then yet they.
Well, again, he may be referring to this message that I alluded to. Not so much sent them to do this. He means he sent them to say, try it out, see how good you are at this. As they were on a mission. The mission wasn't to fail. The mission, in theory, would have been to succeed, or at least to prove the point. One more source, though, just to show you something very interesting. We're all familiar, even though obviously it's not part of, it's part of the Musaf, the Avoda. One of the main things that was done on Yom Kippur was, of course, we even have an English word for it. It's called the scapegoat. Right, one of the central rituals of Yom Kippur was the lottery between the two identical goats, right? One would end up being with Ne'el Kim, would be brought as a carbon, and the other one was taken off to this cliff. And where was it sent? Azazel. Now, what does that mean? So the Gemara in Masechet Yoma wants to know, what does this word Azazel mean? And the Gemara offers different theories. But wouldn't you know it? Look at the bottom of the page. One of the theories is Shemechaper al Maisa Uze v'Azael. That there were two angels named Uzzah and Azael. They did something wrong, and this ritual, in part, is connected to their Avera and the atonement that they needed. Now, that's all the Gemara says. Who are these angels, and what did they do wrong? Let's look at Rashi. This is Rashi on the Gemara. But again, it ties into this other Rashi on our Parsha. Rashi says, Malachei Chavola. These were angels of destruction. Shiyardu la'eretz v'yemei na'ama. Achos Tuval Kayin, a name familiar to us. Naama was the sister of Tuval Kayin, and she apparently was very beautiful. And these two angels got enticed. Ba'alehem Nemar, and it's about these angels and the immoral acts that they did, where the Pasuk, what of all things in the Gemara Yuma, talking about the Yom Kippur Avoda and the Beis HaMikdash, what Pasuk does Rashi pull out? Our Parsha of Yiru B'nei Elohim es B'nosa Adam. That's what the pasuk was referring to. Kolomer al ha'arayos machaper. These angels committed immoral acts with these women, or this woman specifically, or the women in general from Tuval Kayin and Kayin's family. And that, these two angels, that's why it's referred to as Benos Elohim. That's Bnei Elohim because they were angels, but they were angels who fell prey to immorality. So we have three theories. So first of all, we have three theories about who they were. Right? Upper class in terms of the judges or the rulers, upper class spiritual aristocracy, the children of Shais, or they were some form of angels. And we wanted to know, secondly, and more importantly, so what did they do wrong? What was the problem? So working backwards, for sure, really, this in theory, this could be according to any of the opinions, but we see at least according to the opinion that it was angels, what did they do wrong? So far we have one theory. There was some form of sexual immorality. And what we don't yet know is if that was true, even according to the opinion that this was the upper class versus the lower class, like Rav Sajigon, right, who said it was the B'nai HaNesiim and the B'nos HaMoniyam, right? The upper class boys and the lower class girls. So you could have a nice, wonderful shidduch. Beautiful. Right? They say, share the wealth. Right? More too often, right? The rich marry the rich. No, let's have a nice shidduch. And, we could spread the wealth. So what's wrong? We don't yet know. One possible theory is this immorality thing that Rashi quotes. But we don't yet know otherwise what did they do wrong, even though we see that it was terrible and it was a leadership class and it led to whole destruction. Yes. They don't, not that I really understand this, but they don't in their angelic form. But there's an idea that, and this again, we have this perhaps even with like Avraham and, and Vayera and stuff, that when angels sometimes come down to this world, if they're put into human form, then they take just that, human form. So they could eat with Avraham at the tent, and in this case, they could have other earthly desires. Again, well, if we're together for a few more years, it's Wednesday Chumash here, so we'll get to Vayera. Anyone want to predict how many years that would be? Okay. Discretion in this case is wise. Okay, may I have Ephraim. Thank you, Eric. So let's conclude. We have a few more minutes left. Let's see the back of the page. So now we need to know the major question is, what did they do wrong? What happened here? So if you look at Rashi again takes something from the Medrash. Rashi says, Kitovos Heina. We ask the question, what does that mean to say these were good girls? So here, this theory according to Rashi does not lay any of the blame on the girl. But what it says is that the Tovos here is written without a Vav. Amar of Yudin. Tovos without a Vav. It's written Chaser. So what is that hinting at? That there's more to meets the eye. Namely, Shayimativin Osa. When they would dress themselves up, they would put on, we'll see from the Medrash, like makeup, and Mekusheta, she put on her jewelry. Why was she getting dressed up? Likaras L'chuppah was her wedding day, right? What girl doesn't get dressed up and beautiful on her own wedding day? What happened? Hayagodol Nechnas. The superior, the ruler, would then come in, Uboa La Tachila. Right? Like Hanukkah. We're just finishing up Hanukkah, right? This was one of the problems. Right? This is an old, right? In the Roman, it was an old problem. We didn't realize how old it was. According to Rashi, it goes all the way back to the generation of the flood. That one of the cardinal immoralities, the signal problems that was taking place is the women before they were married were being what we would call raped, essentially, by the ruling class. So that's what the pasuk means. These Bnei Elohim, these people from the ruling class, they were taking advantage of all times, the night of the wedding, the day before the wedding, of the girls. Now you'll ask me, so why does it happen? We know that that's why it's told that they're the Bnei Elohim, the ruling class that gave them the abusive power. Why do we need to know that these are Benos HaAdam? So before we see the Medrash, we don't necessarily see the Medrash. The Medrash gives us more problems. But just to keep on this theme, I think the Radak says something so insightful, which I think you can almost anticipate. If they were abusive because they were Bnei Elohim, they were the ruling class, what's significant about the fact that the women are referred to as Benos HaAdam? Exactly, they were more vulnerable. Because if they were daughters of the ruling class, they would have someone to defend them. But here you have a classic example of the powerful taking advantage of the unpowerful. So look at the Radak, it's really powerful language. He also says, like Rasag had said, Benos Hamoni Ha'am, take a look at the Radak. Benos Hamin Ha'adam HaChalushim, right? They came from the weaker, less advantaged families. Therefore, Lo Hayu Lahen Koach Lamod Kenegdam, they couldn't stand up to the abusive rulers. Shahayu Roim Bnei Agadolim Es Benos Ha'anim HaChalushim, and when these rich boys saw the poor girls, Shayatovos, again, who knows exactly what it means by Tovos? Either it means that they were pretty, or it means that they thought they were. Yeah, exactly. More easy prey, or maybe a little bit more pliable. I don't know exactly, but either way, Ratzalomar Yofos Torah Mara, right? Here, when we say the opposite, right? Usually, when we say she's a nice girl, we mean she's not pretty. Here, Tovos means, with the wink of the eye. you know, you don't want your parents there, you talking this way. So you say, she's a nice girl. What you mean is, right, she's a beautiful girl. So therefore, they got these powerful men, Hayu Oshkim, Oshek, right, from the language of Oshek. They would inflict harm or pain. Hayu Lokhim, Eze, Shahayu Bokhrim, Mikalan Hashem. They would just wantonly and freely, with any commitment, any love, any relationship, they would just take them. And then, almost, you know, an editorial aside, says the Radak, the more powerful tend to take advantage of the less powerful. And as he says ominously at the end, and there's no one to protect them. Again, especially in light of the fact that it was the children of the rulers. And they weren't going to get in the way of their, you know, their children, who were clearly raised, you know, to think that everything, you know, to kipmir, anything comes, it comes to me. So the Radak coupled together with the Rashi, now we understand why it's important to identify the boys from the upper side, so to speak, and the girls lower side, because that's what led to, apparently, to the vulnerability. This is an aside. I don't want to read it. We don't have time. But the top medrash not only to say the first part of this, but also points out, in going through the different phrases of the pasuk, points out, yes, they did this. They took advantage of the girls before their wedding night. But also talks about how, and once, you know, when you can take a little, right, then the appetite gets hung, you know, more voracious. Once they figured, hey, we could take any single girl we want, then they said, hey, why limit ourselves to that? The married woman, she looks pretty. They took her. And once you run out of human prey, what do you do? Says the Medrash. Bestiality. They took animals. And then the Medrash ends with a well-known comment as well. It comes from other contexts as well. Namely, that what sealed the deal for the destruction, getting, you know, thinking ahead to Parshas Noach. I'm reading the underlined part from the end of the top source. Dor hamabo lo nimucho min haolam. They were only destroyed. Why? Achikosav gamom sios lazachar ulu behema. They wrote like marriage contracts. Like, in other words, it wasn't just that they were engaged in this case, homosexuality or bestiality, says the Medrash, but they had gay marriage. There's a well-known Rashi in Chulin. I quoted this a few years ago when that issue was discussed in politics. It's eerie in terms of some of the issues that the Western civilization is being challenged with now. It wasn't just, but the point being, and the Medrash is pointing this out, is not, there's one level of immorality when something's being done. But when a society sanctions that level of immorality, it's far, far worse. And that's what the Medrash says also happened in the door of Noah. If you take a look at the Ibn Ezra, just to blow by a few sources, and we'll conclude with the Refersh in a moment, the Ibn Ezra also says that what was going on here was that women were being taken by force, that the ultimate sin here was the abuse of women. Shalokhma Noshim Gamba Chazaka. The Chizkuni says the same thing. Why is Hashem upset? Because the women were being taken against their will. Ramban again. Again, they were being taken against their will. And now I want to mention the Ramban and then conclude the reverse. So Ramban essentially asks Harry's question from the beginning of the shir. And what's wrong? Is there a pasuk yet in Chumash that told the generation of Noach you're not allowed to take a woman against her will? Who said there's anything wrong with that? Or to commit adultery with a married woman? Who said? Harry's question. Right? The Torah didn't tell. The Torah wasn't given yet. So the Ramban says powerfully again, a second nugget of theology for today's shir. Last line of the Ramban. V'lo nigzar aleihem ha'onesh rak al ha'chamas. He points out that the Ramban here, I ran through it, but he has a nuance where he talks about the two different problems. One was the taking advantage of the single girls, and the other was the kind of just sexual morality of the adultery. He says in particular they were punished for the chamas. Chamas means here not just taking what doesn't belong to you like someone else's radio. In this case it means taking who soon to be wife of another person. Lefishu inyan muskal einenu tzarech l'torah. It was rational. It's obvious that you
natural
can.
Law.
In my notes, I wrote the word natural law. That's the Ramban. Right? And there's a. For those who may recall, Shabbat Parshas Miketz, 5 years ago, so it's 5 years and 1 week now, 5 years and 4 days, Friday night, my tryout, my brava, Friday night, this was the topic I spoke about in Shul, natural law. But I didn't know this Ramban then. I don't think I quoted it. But the Ramban says this is a source for the idea of natural law, that of course the Torah is going to come and say, you can't do this, but the fact that the Torah wasn't given yet is not an excuse because they should have known. I just want to conclude with Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is something very fascinating and completely politically incorrect. One theory, we know what the problem was. If it was the angels, it was Stam immorality. If it was the upper class boys and lower class girls, we now know what the problem then was. They were taking advantage of them and forcing themselves. So what's the big problem if it was the boys of Shais and the girls of Kain? What, the girls of Kain can't become Bali Tshuva, they can't do good things, they couldn't in theory, that be a wonderful, beautiful Shidduch? What, the Rashiva's son can't marry a simple girl, he can only marry another Rashiva's daughter? I mean, come on. So what's the problem? What was wrong? So Rav Hirsch gives the following theory. And he basically says, pretty much, yeah, you got to be careful when you make a shidduch. Don't just look at the boy and the girl. You got to look at the families. And certain lines just don't go. There's a kilayim in marriage too. And he basically says there was two different lines. There was the Shais line. That was a fundamentally spiritual line. And then there was the Kayan line of human species that was abandoning Hashem. They're all about science and technology without God at all. They totally had wiped God out. And in such a case, the two won't mix. And usually, and this is unfortunately usually from experience, when you do get a shidduch like that, one side pulls the other, and it's usually the lower side pulling the upper side down. Especially, says Rav Hirsch, when we see from the end of the pasuk, the kol asher bacharu, that the reason that these shidduchim are happening, again, this is a common theme with all the mefarshim, is because they weren't looking at the bigger picture. What kind of family does this girl come from? Is this going to be the type of woman I want to make a family with? How is she going to be as a mother to my children? What type of children are likely to come out of such a relationship? They were just looking at the bachar, what they wanted in the here and now. And apparently these are beautiful girls. And they lusted after them, thinking only about their immediate pleasure, even though they came from good families, spiritual families. But they got enticed and they lost track of the religious dimension of what it means to start a family or to get married, and therefore they lost it. I'll just read the last few snippets of the Rav Hirsch. He says, they did not look from whom they were descended. They did not consider that the children, what children they could expect from mothers brought up in such environments. They simply looked at the girls and they appealed to them. The corruption did not lie with the women themselves, but in their descent, meaning they came from Cain. You can't blame them. They're from 10 generations of corruption. But at the end of the day, that was the values that these girls had, and a boy from a Shais family should have known better. They did not keep themselves to the race of Elohim. Now, I don't know what the original German was, Rav Hirsch. This is translated from English, and once you start throwing around race and not getting married, it lands a little bit rough on a boy born in 1973 living in America. But as I said, I'm not sure if it's the best German translation. I have no idea. And second of all, okay. Rav Hirsch is allowed to be politically incorrect. He was not born in 2007. But this is what Rav Hirsch says. And then he concludes, the sin on which account the following verse must be taken, the necessity indicated, is not. So you had mentioned before, it was Tajin, right? We saw, right? I forgot to bring this back. But you had said at the beginning of the year, Lakachu, oh, they took against their will. So you were correct. Most of the Mefarshim said like you. Rav Hirsch, I didn't quote it. Rav Hirsch says, no, it can't be that that's the bad word. Marriage is used with that verb. Rather, at the end of the Pasuk, Bikal Asher Bacharu, that's the source of the problem. They married girls without considering from where they were taking them. Therein lay the sin. Very, very fascinating. So we've seen three different theories as to who these people were, and the result of the theories of who they were, we have different theories as to what the problem was. But in a nutshell, when we take a step back, these psukim, the two as a unit, in particular Pasuk Beis, is an absolutely critical pasuk, because this is apparently the transition from which we saw already in Pasuk Gimel, and afterwards where Hashem looks at what's going on and says, uh-oh. And again, it's a big uh-oh, as was alluded to before by the Medrash. Not a type of uh-oh that could just be corrected by punishing them, but a type of uh-oh that's going to corrupt an entire society to the point that Hashem says, we just need to wipe it out and start over. Meretz Hashem will begin next week with Pasuk Gimel and continue on this transition towards Parshas Noach.